Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in for Scott Schaefer. And today on The Breakdown, with 2 weeks left in this year's legislative session, we're taking a look at two of the most controversial bills in Sacramento.
That's right, we're going to talk about a fight affecting the state's and potentially nation's fast food industry, as well as Governor Gavin Newsom's Care Court program for Californians with severe mental illness. But first, Guy, an update from Los Angeles County. There will not be a second district attorney recall in California this year. George Gascon is safe for now. Folks who were critics of his who were gathering signatures have failed a second time to get the more than 560,000 signatures necessary, in part because a lot of the signatures they collected were duplicates, right? They were not people who only signed the petition once, and a few of them also ended up being from outside of the county. So disappointment for some of Gascon's critics and a big sigh of relief for his supporters.
And a reality check that, look, most recall attempts fail. I think that's been, we've been in such recall fever here in San Francisco. But even in 2021, when we saw just a record number of attempts at recalling local officials, school board officials, most of those never made it to the ballot. That's right. Kind of, and you know, in years past, there's almost always a brewing recall for the sitting governor that most of the time goes unnoticed and fizzles out. Obviously, big differences here between L.A. and San Francisco. The size stands out, right?
Just a small difference between the size.
50,000 signatures versus, what, 500,000 signatures?
560,000, 60 plus,
and I think also the geographic, you know, the how big L.A. County is made a big difference here. You mentioned the issue of duplicate signatures. I think we can tie that to the fact that the campaign to recall George Gascon ended up having to rely on some direct mail campaigns. Basically, sending signatures, sending petitions directly to people's addresses. And that's why you ended up with, what, 6% of all the signatures back were duplicates. I think a lot of people might have signed something outside of Vons and then signed something again when
it came
to their door. That's not an issue that we really saw at a large scale.
Which
in
is
San
not
Francisco.
Voter fraud, we should say.
Right.
Not voter fraud. I mean, look, it's the county is 10 times bigger than San Francisco County. It is a million things. It is multiple cities. It is just so large. I think that beyond just the sheer number of signatures, creating the momentum, the narrative that you need is really difficult, right? So in San Francisco, we saw some very sort of targeted changes in, say, crime patterns that I think made it very easy to really electrify folks, say, on the West Side, who were seeing a lot of garage break-ins that hadn't been happening pre-pandemic. Just the sort of machine around Nextdoor and Twitter and kind of who got involved, I think, is part of it. And then the fact that in San Francisco, there was some pretty veteran Democratic officials who pushed the run against the DA here, who ultimately lost that recall. You know, that all said, though, this does not mean that Gascon is going to have an easy walk for the next 2 years until he's on the ballot again. The vast majority of deputies in his own office have spoken out or, you know, been polled and said that they oppose a lot of his policies. And I think, you know, if I were giving him some free advice here, I'd say you need to take some time to sort of build some of those relationships both within your office but also within government, and also make the case to the larger electorate that what you're doing is for good reason, that it's not just knee-jerk reactions, because I don't think we've seen, quite frankly, a lot of humility. You know?
I think one thing people are looking for in the short term, though, is what's the impact on the mayor's race in the fall?
Right.
I think this was something, if you're on the campaign for Rick Caruso, you might have been looking for some kind of turnout spark to happen in November to pick up the pace of where he was compared to Karen Bass in the primary. Maybe something like this would have been enough to energize people, get people to the polls. Obviously, without this on the ballot, he'll need something else.
Right. And he already spent $25 million. Karen Bass hasn't even gotten her labor, you know, independent expenditures and door knockers yet. So I do think that this is going to mark a challenge for Caruso to really make that case. I mean, at the end of the day, though, there are so many issues, and, you know, we'll talk about this in future shows, but like, what is going to be driving opinion in a few months even? It's like hard to tell right now, less than 100 days out. All right, another big issue. Let's turn to the fast food fight at the state capitol. We're talking about Assembly Bill 257. It would create a new state council to set wages and working conditions for fast food workers in California. We saw supporters sleeping outside lawmakers' office in the capitol this week to push for a yes vote, while restaurant groups are shelling out millions for TV ads in opposition. And with us is KQED's labor correspondent, Farida Javala-Romero. Hey, Farida.
Hi, Marisa. Hi, Guy.
Hey.
Thanks for being here. So tell us what this bill would do. Why is this such a hot button issue right now?
Right. So this is a bill that aims to improve conditions for people working in the fast food industry. And, you know, just to remind listeners, that's more than 500,000 people in California. Most of them are adults, not teenagers, and many are women of color. So basically, this bill, like you said, would first create a council that would include representatives from workers and business owners that would set standards, minimum standards for the industry. And another sort of groundbreaking thing the bill would do, which could end up changing things in other states as well, is that it would hold fast food corporations liable for any violations of labor laws at their franchise restaurants.
That's big.
So most fast food restaurants are franchises. They're owned by small business owners that pay fees to McDonald's or Taco Bell or other corporations to represent the brand.
Yeah, I want to ask about that liability piece. I think that's maybe why businesses are spending so much against this bill. Marisa mentioned the ads. Maybe we'll get a break from the sports betting ads. Is that possible to see another issue on TV? But Frida, talk about their stance on this, these business groups, and kind of how they see a change to that liability affecting their business model.
So, you know, from people who support the bill, they see making these corporations liable for violations at their franchises as a way to sort of force the corporations to, you know, help improve conditions for workers, including in issues like wage theft. But from the California Restaurant Association, the California Chamber of Commerce, or the International Franchise Association that opposed the bill, I mean, they say that the fast food industry is not violating laws disproportionately compared to other industries, and that this bill would make it a lot harder for small business owners with franchises to survive and could lead to job losses, and that it'll increase the cost of fast food for consumers. So they're really worried about this one.
I mean, are those fair concerns? You know, we have a lot of industries that are sort of better regulated than this. And I know that you've reported extensively on the issue of wage theft. You know, what are the counterpoints to that argument in terms of the economic impacts on, as you said, the largely adult people who are trying, you know, to make ends meet through these types of jobs?
Yeah, I mean, wage theft, of course, is when a worker is not paid by their employer what they're owed. Sometimes it's people not getting minimum wage or overtime pay or all their sick hours. It's really hard to estimate, but we know it's huge, that it's costing about $2 billion just for minimum wage violations in California, according to a study by the Economic Policy Institute. And we know it especially impacts vulnerable low-wage workers, including undocumented ones, who can probably least afford to be robbed, including in the fast food industry. There's recent surveys that show really high rates of wage theft among fast food workers, including by the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which is a co-sponsor of this bill. And so they hope that, you know, like I mentioned, like if big corporations are made responsible for labor law violations at their franchises, that it's really going to change things, not just in California, but in other states.
Yeah.
The main argument we're hearing in these opposition ads is that the bill is going to lead to further hikes in food prices. Obviously, that's a issue that is resonating for a lot of voters, given the inflation that we have.
Yeah.
Is that a legitimate concern when it comes to what this bill is proposing to do?
Well, so what we know is the International Franchise Association commissioned researchers at the UC Riverside Center for Economic Forecast and Development to study this. And they just came out with a new report. The idea is that, you know, if this new council increases compensation for workers from minimum wage, which is $16 an hour, to something more like living wage, which is definitely more than that, especially in the Bay Area, the prices of fast food will also go up. And they're estimating around 20%. Now, of course, the researchers don't really know for sure if or how much this new council would raise wages for workers. So this is totally an estimate. But this is, you know, a report that just came out, and the researchers say the International Franchise Association did pay them to do this, but that the research is independent.
So, Frida, obviously a lot of interest. You mentioned that there's concern from the restaurant industry that this would really be sort of a bar setting type of policy that could spread across the nation, is one way to get around some of the limitations of federal labor laws. But this is not by any means a sure thing, right? We've seen this really divide Democrats. The governor's own Department of Finance came out as opposed to it. Yeah. So even if this gets out of the legislature, what do you think the chances are that it actually gets signed by Governor Newsom?
God.
Put your betting hat on, Farida.
Well, you know, I have to say, like, this opposition by the Department of Finance, what they're really worried about is that the bill will increase enforcement responsibilities for state agencies like Cal OSHA and the Labor Commissioner's Office that are already super understaffed often and are having a lot of trouble, protecting workers and, you know, being able to pursue investigations of wage theft. Like, our own reporting at KQED has shown that workers in California can wait years to get a hearing on a complaint of wage theft, for example.
Right.
And by the time they actually get a resolution from the agency, the business in question might have already closed, you know, so it's really difficult for them to recover any of that money. So the Department of Finance, what they're saying is that they're opposed to this bill because they see it would create significant costs for these agencies, and that it would create sector specific, you know, rulemaking body within the Department of Industrial Relations, which oversees many of these agencies. But in terms of, you know, whether, I don't even know if the full Senate, we know the full Senate is expected to vote on this bill before the end of the month, and we'll see what the result is. And then it definitely, you know, it's really, like you said, you know, it's so controversial. It's really an unknown.
Make you make any predictions. Frida Chavala-Romero, thank you so much for joining us. She is KQED's labor correspondent.
Thanks, Frida.
Thank you.
All right. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about Governor Gavin Newsom's controversial plan for mentally ill Californians with Jason Elliott. He's a top advisor to the governor. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I am Marisa Lagos, here today with Guy Marzorati. We are thrilled to be joined by Jason Elliott. He is senior counselor to Governor Gavin Newsom on housing and homelessness. Welcome to The Breakdown, Jason.
Thank you very much for having me, Guy and Marisa. Good to be here.
Yeah, so you have been working on this Care Court proposal for the bulk of this year, really on the ground in the nitty-gritty of the policy. But for those who might not be as familiar with it, tell us the basic framework and idea behind this proposal.
Sure, happy to. Thanks. So Care Court is a new way of helping people in California who are not getting the help they need. They're living a lot of times on the streets and sidewalks and encampments. They're suffering from really, really severe mental health issues, substance abuse issues. And the systems that we have in California right now are not serving them or not serving them well. And the proof of that is that they're living on the streets and sidewalks. We have a multi-billion dollar response system in California. We are spending $14.7 billion on homelessness, but we see people that are living in encampments. So something's not adding up. And the question is why? And the answer is we need something like Care Court. So I'm happy to go into more detail, but what it is trying to bridge the gap in the systems that we have in California to get people help, people who are not being served right now.
But it's not just about homelessness, right? This is really about mental health treatment and access. So what are the mechanisms that would help y'all tackle that? Because there are people we hear about all the time who have families and housing and still can't get the help they need.
It's a good point that you make, and I'm glad that you did. This is not just about homelessness, and it's not just for homeless people. Part of the reason that you're right in asking that question is because a homeless Californian can be a housed Californian. He may be able to move back in with his parents for a while and try to be stable and try to heal. But you know what? That mental health challenge is so severe, or that drug addiction is so severe, that that housed Californian is a homeless Californian for a while, and then maybe housed again and so forth. I guess what I'm saying is being homeless isn't like having brown hair. It's not a permanent state. It's something that we can resolve and then it can happen again. And so I appreciate the point you're making. Care Court is not for homelessness. Care Court is for people with really acute mental health conditions and oftentimes with co-occurring substance abuse conditions. So you're right about that. And I guess to answer your question, what is it? It's a civil court procedure. It's a civil court process. It's new. It doesn't exist yet. The governor's looking forward to signing it into law in a matter of weeks. And it creates a new pathway through the civil courts, not the criminal courts. And that's really important because under Care Court, no judge can sentence anybody to go behind a locked door against their will. In Care Court, it's 100% community-based placements in community-based clinics, in permanent supportive housing type placements, or if appropriate for the client, in a private home. Because sometimes people can heal and can live sustainably at home with a loved one, with family. That's not going to work for everybody, though. And we know that we need to make major strides in building more kind of clinic care and homeless housing to really solve this problem.
Jason, you mentioned the existing systems. We already have a law, Lohr's Law, where, you know, if I have a sibling with severe mental illness, I'm afraid they're going to get 5150'd, end up in a conservatorship, kind of spiraling towards that. I can petition a court for outpatient treatment. So how is this different than that?
It's a good question. And it's a question, Guy, I get a lot. And here's my answer. Care Court is what I think you think Lohr's Law is. Care Court is what we all sort of expect Lohr's Law would be. And here's what I mean by that. Lohr's Law serves on average about 200, 218 people a year in California, not in San Francisco, not in Oakland, in California. So it's just not really working, right? It's working perhaps well for a couple hundred people statewide. But really what you've just described, Guy, can be the beginning of the description of Care Court, right? And I guess that's my point is Care Court is what I think we all expect something like Lohr's Law should have been designed as or should be. And just to put a little bit finer of a point on that, Care Court is different than Lohr's Law in one key way: accountability. Accountability. If in the case of Lohr's Law, someone is petitioned that, you know, petitions the court and ends up in a Lohr's Law placement, and you know, you really ought to have supportive clinical enhanced housing and you ought to have these kinds of services. It's a you ought to have. Under Care Court, it's the county is obligated to provide. And the individual is obligated to avail himself or herself of those things. And there are consequences if individuals or local governments, for the first time ever, local governments don't step up and provide the services and the housing that is ordered by the court. And that accountability piece, especially for our local government partners, is novel and we think is a real game changer.
Okay, so I have a sister who is struggling. I petition the court. She, you know, goes into the system. She has, I think, an advocate in the court, a defender, a public defender, essentially. And there's a plan created. So that could be housing, that could be behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse. The county has to provide it. You've been traveling around talking to cities and counties about that. And we know that there's been a lot of pushback from counties that they do not have the ability to do this, right? We have Kaiser workers striking right now over the fact that even some of our private healthcare systems don't have mental health access and enough, you know, therapists and such. So talk about that piece. Like, what's your response to that? How sure. can counties do this if they don't feel like they have the resources?
Sure. First, I'll say we've heard all of those concerns directly from counties as well. So you're absolutely right to name it as a challenge, Marisa. I think, you know, I worked in local government a long time before I came to the state. And the reason that I mention that is because for years and years and years in California, there was no assistance from state government when it came to housing and homelessness. We were effectively, as counties, I worked in the city and county of San Francisco, we were effectively left to our own devices to design strategies and to pay for things. So counties suggesting we don't have enough money to do this is a scarcity mindset that was based in a lot of truth for many, many decades. And this spans governors, Republican, Democrat, across the spectrum, no picking on anybody. But it was true. There was a scarcity mindset from the state funding perspective on homelessness for decades. 3 years ago, the governor, Governor Newsom, came into office and said, I'm going to attack this issue head on. He gave an entire State of the State speech about one topic, homelessness. And since then, the three budgets since then, Governor Newsom and the legislature have committed $14.7 billion directly to homelessness. And, you know, $14.7 billion is a number that's sort of hard to put your mind around. But I'll say the biggest single investment in homelessness that was made by the state up to that point was $500 million in Jerry Brown's last budget. So that's 28X or whatever it sort of is, right? But let's not talk about $14.7 billion because I don't know what a $14.7 billion looks like. But I will say that's 55,000 new permanent supportive housing units, clinical beds, board and care units and places, shelters, tiny homes, sorts of things for people to exit homelessness. 55,000 new placements. And 55,000 placements can serve many more than 55,000 people because in some of these cases, people can rotate through them. So that's, I guess, it's a very long way of saying that the scarcity mindset that was so pervasive around California for many decades is really a little bit outdated. And the amount of money that is now being invested in this issue by the governor and the legislature is unprecedented in the truest sense of that word. So I think that the message that we have shared directly with our county partners, and I will say partners because the success of Care Court entirely depends on counties putting their shoulder into it and really making this work. So in fact, I don't use partners as a throwaway political word. I really mean these are our partners. And the conversation that we're having with them is a very healthy one. And it's around prioritization. And I want to focus on that word. Because what we are arguing with Care Court is that those who are suffering from the most acute mental health conditions on the streets, who are causing the most public safety concerns for neighborhoods and for themselves, we need to prioritize them above all else. And that's a controversial thing to say. But I would argue that if we're not prioritizing those individuals, well, what the heck are we doing here? Right? These are folks who at this point in their lives are really headed towards one of three outcomes, prison or jail or some sort of incarceration, which is a terrible outcome, something like a state hospital. In California, state hospitals are where people are put when they're locked up for conservatorships. So, you know, prison, state hospital, or God forbid, but all too frequently, untimely death. That's really what we're talking about here, right? So if we're not prioritizing those individuals, what's the point of any of this is really sort of the question, the rhetorical question that we ask.
Well, I hear you talking about the investments in housing, but on Marisa's point to the mental health services, I mean, that's something mm-hmm. we've heard opponents talk about with this bill. Most recently, the editorial pages in the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, they've highlighted this potential shortfall of mental health workers if this bill is implemented. Mm-hmm. The LA Times writes, quote, the Care Courts program would be like adding an additional door to a building that's too small to hold the people already inside. What's your response to that?
Yeah, Guy, I think that analogy that particular article uses really is operating in that old scarcity mindset. We're massively expanding the size of that building, in this case, literally and figuratively. But look, we don't have enough mental health workers and healthcare workers in California, and it's a critical problem. And I will mention that the governor and the legislature is responding in part by investing many billions of dollars to fund the development, career development of about 65,000 different healthcare workers, and that's including licensed clinical social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and also community health workers that can be out in community in a culturally competent way, talking to people in language or in culture. So really, we're investing not just in the little things to try to solve the problem right now, but in creating career pathways for, as I said, 65,000 new clinical health workers to answer that exact question. So Guy, it's a real issue and we're putting forward real solutions.
Do you think when you talk about the $14.5 billion for housing and homelessness, this new
$14.7 billion, as a matter of fact,
what's a couple hundred million, you know, Jason, when we're talking billions?
I'm old enough to remember when $200 million in homelessness was a big deal, but I take your point.
But, you know, we talk a lot in a city like where we live in Los Angeles about the billions of dollars that have been invested in both that, but also in mental health, and obviously not to the effect we all want to see. Is there anything you have found that tells you counties are misusing this money when it comes to things like behavioral health, sitting on it? Like, if there's this big bucket and everybody's still saying we don't have enough, you know?
Yeah. Look, I think misusing is a really loaded word, right? I think everybody's trying to do their best. And one of the things that was always lacking from the state, it wasn't just money. It was also leadership and a structure of best practice. Oh my God, best practice. What a political, like, you know, government-y wonky thing to say. But what it really means is when we find something that works, let's make sure that all 58 counties in California are adhering to those kinds of models. I'll give you an example, Marisa. Homeless housing, what we call permanent supportive housing in California, we basically just came to accept that it takes about 3 years to build a unit, 4 years to build a unit, and it costs about $500,000. We just sort of came to accept that as just what it takes, right? And in Los Angeles, those numbers are higher. Well, you know, you asked the question about our counties misusing money. I would sort of answer in a slightly different way. We've all accepted inefficiency in our response. The Home Key program, which maybe your listeners are familiar with, is a program where we bought hotels and motels around the state, vacant office buildings, built modular housing for homeless people. And we well exceeded 10,000 units in the Home Key program in just 2 years. Home Key units come online in, and it's measured in months, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 months, not 3 years, 9 months, not 3 years, $200,000, not $500,000. So that's a model, right? And what I would argue is you can do twice as much, twice as fast if you try new models. And what I would argue is not that counties are misusing money or that anybody's doing anything bad or sitting on piles of money with gobs of savings. What I'd argue is that in the homelessness housing space, we came to accept inefficient solutions and inefficient responses. And if we can modernize the way we respond, we can do better with just as much as we had. But we don't have to stop with just as much as we had. As I just mentioned, we've invested even more.
Jason, we got about a minute left, but I want to talk about the families of folks who have these severe mental health issues in California. We know oftentimes that derails an entire family's life. I'm wondering if you can describe, if this plan is enacted, if it works exactly how you see it, how will those families' lives change?
30 seconds.
Yeah. 30 seconds. Well, I'm going to take longer than 30 seconds. So this is the big challenge on Care Court, is that we're meeting lots of these families and we're meeting these moms and dads and sitting at tables with them and looking them in the eye. And the real challenge on Care Court is keeping a promise to them. I sat across the table in really literally in person from a mother who told me that her daughter, I raised my daughter right. I loved her. We gave her everything in the world. She is a prostitute on Skid Row, and we don't know where she is. And the only time I know she's safe is when she's in jail. Please do Care Court. Now, to me, you know, you talk about the political challenges of Care Court or the budget challenges of Care Court. Those are all real. We have to win passage in the state assembly next week. And, you know, these are hurdles. The real challenge in Care Court is keeping the promise to that mother that this is going to be a real program.
Jason Elliott, thank you so much. Jason Elliott is an advisor to Governor Gavin Newsom on housing and homelessness. That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. Our producer is the guy over here, Guy Marzorati.
Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. I'm Guy Marzorati. Find me on Twitter @GuyMarzorati.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Find me on Twitter @MLagos. Have a good one.